Welcome back to the course on family-based youth ministry. This is tape two, side A. This side of the tape, we're going to begin to work on the impact of the isolation that we talked about in the last session. Just a few thoughts to get you thinking as we get moving on this. From Jane Nelson and Stephen Glenn in their fabulous book, Raising Self-Reliant Children in a Self-Indulgent World, they say, "The lack of dialogue and collaboration between the more mature and the less mature threatens the bonds of closeness, trust, and dignity and respect that hold our society together. People are basically tribal creatures. Human beings have never done well in isolation." Then from Ken Myers in his book, All God's Children and Blue Suede Shoes. Dick Clark's longevity as the premier impresario of rock is a symbol of rock music's Peter Pan myth of eternal youth. The sight and sound of the Beach Boys, and then he says in parentheses, "Boys, these guys are almost ready for Social Security." The Beach Boys pretending they will still belong on the beach, that they still belong on the beach, impressing the young bimbos, that's an embodiment of the romantic myth of youth. And then Children at Risk, James Dobson says, "Never forget that the children of overcommitted, harassed, exhausted parents are sitting ducks for the con men of our age." And then let me read this one, and you guess where it's from. "The young men are in character prone to desire and ready to carry out any desire they may have formed into action. Of bodily desires, it is the sexual to which they are most opposed to give away. And in regard to sexual desire, they exercise no self-restraint. They are changeful, too, and fickle in their desires, which are transitory as they are vehement. For their wishes are keen without being permanent, like a sick man's fits of hunger and thirst." That's from the 4th century from Aristotle. And two more. From Marion Wright Edelman from the Children's Defense Fund, she says, "The inattention to children by our society poses a greater threat to our safety, harmony, and productivity than any external enemy." And finally, this riveting quote from a 14-year-old student who was quoted in the Chicago Times. "In a way, it's a good thing adults don't know much about us teens. If they knew much about us, they'd puke." Well, here we are. We're going to talk about the developmental disaster. How God's design for adolescence being a time of identity formation and clarifying and moving into adulthood, how that has been severely sidetracked in our culture, primarily because of what we talked about in the last session, primarily because our culture, like a centrifuge that we're spinning so fast that our kids are being pulled apart. There's very little that's holding them together with a sense of identity, because all they have to hang on to is themselves. So let's begin, and we'll do some additional reflections at the end of this session. One of the summer highlights for our Texas youth group was an annual New Braunfels tubing trip. Aside from having to load 50 inflated tubes on top of the church bus, I loved everything about the trip. I actually enjoyed being thrown down the river chute with the kids, and I loved ending the day with a 3-mile float downriver. But between the chute and the floating parts of the trip, every tuber had to go over a simple 3-foot waterfall. Most were thrown head over heels into the water, gasping between squeals of laughter. But those that weren't thrown from their tubes found themselves in an even more frustrating situation. They got stuck at the bottom of the falls. Now, it might take a physicist to explain why, but somehow the falls had created a current, what some have described to me as a hydraulic, that made it nearly impossible to paddle away. No matter how vigorously the people in the tubes paddled, the current would pull them back toward the falls. I was almost always fortunate enough to be thrown from my tube, so I watched our group with enjoyment each time they attempted to gather on the other side of the falls for our day-ending float. Those who stayed in their tubes frantically paddled away from the falls, only to be immediately sucked right back in. The peculiar current of that place kept people stuck, unable to move forward. And unless they got out of their tubes or someone from the outside, someone who had already been through the waterfall already, reached out and helped them, there simply was no way out. Now, over the years, I have listened, and I like to collect images to describe where adolescents are in general and where adolescents in our culture are particularly. And I have found no clearer picture of what our culture does to teenagers than this picture of the New Braunfels waterfall. There's really no better way to describe that I have found how young people have become stuck developmentally. And paddle as they might away from childhood, the current of their own culture keeps pulling them back, keeping them tied to an immature and dependent kind of lifestyle. Now, the U.S. Census Bureau confirms the increasing difficulty that young adults are having becoming independent. During the 1980s, more than half, it was actually 54% of adults between the ages of 18 and 24 were still living at home. That was up from 47% in 1970. In addition, more than 1 in 10 adults between the ages of 25 and 35 were still at home, compared to 8% in 1970. I did hear the other day, and I may have mentioned this on the other tape, I have heard recently, and I have not chased this down, so I don't know if it's actually documented or not, but someone quoted a statistic that said 70% of our young people who graduate from college are now going back to spend at least 1 year at home. Now, there are many cultural forces, particularly financial forces, that are requiring that to happen. But it's fascinating how our culture is making it increasingly difficult for kids to move away from adulthood. And the irony is that this is at the very same time when we're giving kids freedom earlier and earlier. In other words, our culture is saying to kids, you deserve the freedom when you're 12 or 13, but they really don't have the wherewithal to be independent until sometimes 25 or even 30 years old. It's quite a bind. It's like the pair of jeans in the mule commercial on the back of the Levi's, where the mules are pulling the jeans in two different directions. That's kind of the bind we're putting our kids in. The bridge from childhood to adulthood is getting longer and longer. Young people in our time are stuck in a peer-centered culture, as we talked about last time. And unless we can find the footing to step out of that culture, unless they can find that, they'll be perpetually stuck in adolescence. And incidentally, our, in general, a consumer culture highly values immature people. Why? Because immature people tend to be more impulsive consumers than do mature people. And so a culture that thrives, a capitalistic culture that thrives on buying, particularly buying trivial and non-essential things, loves keeping its customers immature and impulsive. There is some payoff for our culture, for our kids being this way. Long term, our culture, we all lose. But short term, people make money off of this syndrome. Okay, I want you to just imagine, I want you to close your eyes. If you're driving in the car, please don't do that. But otherwise, close your eyes. I want you to imagine a group of junior high kids that you know or work with or familiar with. Imagine that they say to each other that they have decided to teach each other how to scuba dive. That's right. One boy, picture in your mind the most outspoken junior higher that you see in that group. He would argue that he understands exactly how it's done. He's seen it 100 times on television. And one of the girls might remember a book about sea explorers she checked out in the third grade. And a third person might brag that he has the entire collection of Sea Hunt or maybe Flipper movies on video cassette. They might even all agree that one or more of them know what they're talking about. But if they actually attempted to teach each other how to scuba dive, what do you think would happen? Now you can open your eyes. What happens? Well, as I give this example with groups that I speak with, they almost in unison say they drown. If we sent them off 60 miles offshore in an ocean, in the ocean, and said, okay, we're gonna learn how to scuba dive, many of them wouldn't make it back. Again, that's an illustration for us of this horizontal culture where kids only learn from people who know about the same thing that they do. And it's very difficult to learn a lot from people who don't know anything. Teenagers will not learn the skills required of mature adults in a peer-centered youth Sunday school class. They will not learn these skills by talking to their friends. The process occurs as the less mature repeatedly have the opportunity to observe and dialogue and collaborate with the more mature. But by denying teenagers opportunities for this kind of involvement with adults, our culture sends its youth into the adult years relationally, mentally, and morally unprepared for the challenge of adulthood. So for this lecture, those are going to be my 3 points. The relational problems, the mental problems, and the moral problems that come as a result of a culture that isolates its young people from adulthood. First of all, let's talk about what I call relational retardation. A film producer recently described the crisis among today's youth in this way. For too long, young people have been told their greatest problems are drugs, sex, alcohol, etc. These are, in fact, only symptoms of a greater disease. The disease of youth is that, and this is my ellipsis, that the key relationships are in disarray. Their relationships with God, self, parents, and the world. Do you remember the movie The Breakfast Club? It gives a clue at the cause of this disease in relationships. You remember in that movie, a group of very mismatched teenagers are serving detention together on a Saturday morning. There are no adults in significant parts of the movie. You remember, the only adult is in some other room, and he drops little assignments in, and he walks away. Again, a great picture of what our culture does to young people. After some uncomfortable moments and a few joints of marijuana, the group begins to talk. Interestingly, they were not able to do that without some outside stimulus. Soon, the intimacy of the group grows intense. They have a taste of transparent, honest relationships. But they know that when they go back to school on Monday, there's a good chance that things will return to normal. The best that youth culture has to offer, many of our youth relationally, is fragmented experiences of intense intimacy that can seldom be sustained. Characteristically, teenagers do not have the relational and developmental capacity to maintain a single committed relationship for an extended period of time. They flow in and out of relationships with their peers. That's why this year's enemy is often next year's best friend and vice versa. And even in more serious relationships, the skills that are learned are often the skills of dating, going together, and of course breaking up. One of the keys to successful adult relationships, on the other hand, the ones beyond the superficial level, relationships like marriage and parenting, church membership, one of the keys to successful adult relationships is a commitment to demonstrate love in spite of pain, in spite of conflict, in spite of confusion. Could it be that one of the reasons for the Western nation's devastating divorce rate is that our young people are not learning the skills of genuine love? Young people learn to love through the long haul as they're surrounded by adults who over and over again demonstrate this kind of enduring, long-suffering love. Now, do you see how our culture in training kids essentially how to break up, how to weave through relationships, how to have one friend and then lose it and have a new friend, does not do a great deal to prepare them for the kind of commitment that our culture expects them to make when they make these permanent vows in marriage? I recently talked to a man whose wife decided that their marriage was just not working out. She wasn't interested in counseling. Incidentally, I've heard this same story repeated over and over and over. She just wanted her marriage to end. Her final words to him as he walked out the door sounded hauntingly reminiscent of the words a teenager uses when he or she breaks up with his or her boyfriend. You know what she said? She said, I just want to be friends. Now, you see, if a teenage boy stops feeling love for his girlfriend, or if he's attracted to another girl, he can simply break up and go out with someone else. In a marriage, when a man stops feeling love for his wife or is attracted to someone else's wife, the mature Christian adult behaves very differently. In youth culture, the God-ordained natural process of attraction or falling in love has been elevated to consume a young person's understanding of what real love is. Teenagers have learned to believe that they are simply victims of a feeling that comes and goes. Consequently, they learn to obey that loving feeling at all costs. As a result, increasing numbers of our young people enter adulthood lacking the relational maturity to establish long-term relationships. Now, if you talk to a group of young people and you find out who they hang out with, unless they are deeply connected with their parents, as fortunately many, an increasing number of young people are in churches today, unless they're in that situation, the reality is they have very, very few folks modeling for them in a way that they're collaborating and connecting with what it's like to be in mature adult relationships. Okay. The second characteristic of this developmental disaster that I'm talking about is what I call cognitive fragmentation. In other words, the inability to have a clear picture of a single paradigm or a single worldview that everything fits into. What kids are getting are fragmented pieces of information, and they have very little way of hanging on to the whole picture. Because teenagers now have less time and dialogue with adults, the door has been opened for the media to play a much more powerful role in the formation of young people's values. Even the TV Guide has acknowledged that the more children are isolated from their parents, the more susceptible those children are to the powers of television. Here's what TV Guide says. The children who are more inclined to go along with television, to lap up his messages uncritically, are those who have received little in the way of guidance at home. Hence their susceptibility to whatever the big tube sends their way. Now, isn't it interesting, as we have debates about censorship, that often those in the entertainment industry will say it's the parents' responsibility. Now, it seems to me that the responsible parents are already taking responsibility. But it does seem as if the culture has some responsibility to protect those young people for whom there are no parents taking responsibility. And to throw that out and say all parents ought to take responsibility is to deny the reality of a culture in which many parents are simply neglecting their children, particularly in creating protective boundaries for them when it comes to entertainment. What makes television's impact so potent is the radical change that takes place in the way we process information. Neil Postman, in his challenging book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, claims that American society has actually gone through a transformation in the way we think, and I think he's right. He suggests that we've moved from a word-centered culture to an image-centered culture. Let me illustrate that for you. Postman says that in their time, the first 15 presidents would not have been recognized if they walked down the street. The average American would simply not know who they were. But in contrast, let me just ask you, when you think the first 15 presidents would be remembered by their words, okay? Let me ask you, I'm going to give you some names. Tell me what immediately comes to your mind. Is it words or is it a picture? Richard Nixon. I don't know about you, but I got the picture of him with the victory sign, or his saying, I'm not a criminal, those kind of things. Billy Graham. Do you have a picture of his words or of him? Or Albert Einstein, of course. We've all got that picture of Albert Einstein with his mussed-up hair. What comes to our minds first is an image, and most of us have few words to link to that image. Postman argues that the inherent danger in this new kind of thinking is this. He says, you can only photograph a particular fragment of the here and now, a cliff or a certain terrain, or a certain condition of light, or a wave at a moment in time, from a particular point of view. And just as nature and the sea cannot be photographed, such larger abstractions as truth and love and honor and falsehood cannot be talked about with the lexicon of pictures. Our culture's growing dependence on images for thinking has limited our ability to make moral decisions, or for many, even be able to understand abstract moral concepts. When our young people are taught to speak and think primarily in the language of images and not logical thoughts or moral, when they're taught to think in images and not logical thoughts, moral principles and Christian values may seem to them like so much babbling in a different language. Living in an image-centered culture produces adults who are more moved by impression than by rational thinking. The ability to sustain a logical, linear argument is developed primarily in the context of extended discourse with thinking adults. Because of their isolation from the world of adults in our educational system, teenagers seldom have the opportunity to learn and practice the skills of assessment and judgment with those who actually have those skills. As a result, teenagers have learned to argue anecdotally, and actually often our culture does this as well, and to respond most energetically to anecdotal proofs that use fragmented images and emotional stories instead of logical arguments. Illustration. R. Jackson Wilson, who's a professor of history at Smith College, he's had 25 years to watch students and their abilities. And he, as he observes them, he confirms what I'm suggesting. He says, students today are ready to tell you how they feel about an issue, but they've never learned how to construct a rational argument to defend their opinions. Now, if we make our decisions in our culture, we begin to make them exclusively based on images and stories and emotions and anecdotes rather than on logical, reasoned discourse. We cut ourselves off from the real source of how we come to know, make wise decisions. When a culture or a particularly the legislature, when they make decisions not thinking but based on story, based on fragmented images, then we're in trouble. Teenagers' isolation from adults has left many of them unable to think critically. They're easily swayed by what feels right at the moment, whether it's going to church or buying a $200 pair of tennis shoes or having sex. Without the habit of critical thinking, our teenagers become easy prey to anyone who has something to sell. Well, let's talk about the moral handicap. So, first of all, we have relational retardation. And second, cognitive fragmentation. And the third part of the developmental disaster is what I call the moral handicap. You may remember the haunting story of 14-year-old Rod Matthews. His story serves as a warning to a culture that's beginning to go adrift. Rod was not interested in things that normally interest teenagers. Neither sports or books were enough to quench his insatiable boredom. Only one thing excited him: death. He spent hours watching the video Faces of Death, a collection of film clips of people dying violently. Rod's curiosity about death led him to want to see death personally, not just on the television or the movie screen. Eventually, he found a way to satisfy his curiosity. And one winter afternoon, he lured a friend out in the woods and proceeded to beat him to death with a baseball bat. During his trial for murder, the most telling remark was made by the child psychiatrist. This is by Rod's psychiatrist, who was asked to give a clinical evaluation of Rod's condition. The doctor's assessment was that Rod was not insane in the conventional sense, but that he simply didn't know right from wrong. He was, quote, morally handicapped. Rod's story presents an extreme result, certainly. But it's an example, and I think that's an appropriate phrase, a moral handicap. What happens to our young people when they grow up in a culture that isolates them from the structures that will help to lead them to adulthood is they grow to be handicapped morally. Our society has begun to abandon its responsibility for teaching moral values to its children. Not all, but in general, because of the speed, the the centrifugal force of the speed that people are moving, particularly parents. Often kids pay the price for that, and one of the ways they do that is morally. The horizontal peer culture is not enough. When the vertical structure that connects kids with adults is eroded, we shouldn't be surprised that young people grow up having a difficulty to having firm values of their own. Now think, for example, about the Just Say No campaign of a decade or so ago. It was indicative of the moral inability of our young people. You remember, before the Just Say No campaign, our culture had spent millions of dollars on drug education campaigns. It focused on giving young people rational reasons for not taking drugs. And then in the 80s, the mid-80s, the government determined that a rational approach was simply not the way to reach this group of young people. The Just Say No campaign, a marketing campaign, was developed partly because the leaders recognized that this new generation makes its major moral decisions not by rational argument, but by being sold a certain standard. The Just Say No campaigns were essentially ineffective in lower income areas of inner cities. It's interesting because in these cases, the horizontal peer culture, particularly in gangs, outweighed any message from the mainstream culture. No matter how well it was sold from the mainstream culture, the peer culture and gangs are a great example of a solid peer culture. Those values, those connections were so strong that the selling from outside that culture was not successful. The young people who are fortified with significant relationships with adults are consistently the ones who are able to resist involvement in negative behaviors. Their relationships with these adults gives teenagers perhaps the most compelling argument for making moral choices. Now, this is exactly what Stephen Glenn and Jane Nelson's research has confirmed. They point out that peer influence correlates closely to the rise in rebellion, resistance, chemical abuse, and promiscuity. Children who have strong perceptions of closeness and trust with significant adults are highly resistant to peer influence and more heavily influenced by those adults who validate them for who they are. Young people in our culture are increasingly unprepared to live as mature adults. For the most part, they enter adulthood relationally retarded, cognitively fragmented, and morally handicapped. Their own culture keeps them trapped in immaturity, trapped like at the bottom of the falls at New Braunfels, training them to be reactive victims rather than proactive Christians. Now, before we end this discussion about the impact of the isolation of young people from the world of adults, I want to talk just a bit about the hidden hazards of youth culture. Perhaps the most tragic shift over the past 50 years has been that we've begun to treat adolescents as adults rather than as children in transition toward adulthood. And I know it's a bit of a controversial statement because many would argue that to describe teenagers as children is a pejorative, negative sort of term. I want to say that we've got to acknowledge that that there's only one. Adults are the only adults, and in our culture, unless we become clear that adolescents are on their way to adulthood, we end up. What we're doing is bestowing on them freedoms that tend to be destructive, not requiring of them the responsibility that will give them the resilience and the strength and the durability to make it as adults. Again, we put them in this double bind. So I want to make my case, and I may have mentioned in the last tape about this person I heard talking about the elevator surfing. She described the college students there consistently as children. And I went up to her after the talk was over, and I said, are you serious? Are you intentionally calling 20-year-old college students children? And she said, absolutely, absolutely, because they are not at a place either culturally, socially, or developmentally that they are independent and are able to function as adults, and they're not acting as adults. At any rate, I want to acknowledge that that's my somewhat controversial opinion about the dangers of referring to young, not being able to refer to teenagers that they're not adults. And what's happened is we've no longer referred to them as those moving toward adulthood. We're referring to them as those who somehow are in an in-between place, and we don't quite know what to do with them. And my thinking is it's time for some definition in that department. All right. Although there are many things about being a teenager that should be honored and enjoyed, adolescence, like childhood, is a stage that one should grow out of. The result of successfully completing adolescence is to no longer be an adolescent. Just as perhaps one might say the goal of childhood is to be strong and mature enough to no longer be a child. If you have successfully completed childhood, you are no longer a child. But for teenagers in our culture, the line between childhood and adulthood have increasingly become blurred, so much so that many adults well into their 20s still behave with the characteristics of adolescence. With few clear rites of passage, teenagers are in the double bind of being expected to make adult decisions in a world that consistently juvenilizes them. We idolize youth in our culture as an end in itself. We remove the healthy protection that comes, the healthy protection that growing things require. George Will pinpoints the problem. He says, in Randall Jarrell's novel, Pictures of an, from an Institution, a foreign visitor says, "You Americans do not rear children, you incite them. You give them food and shelter and applause." And then Will goes on to reflect and he says, "The problem is juvenophilia. The problem is this sort of obsessive love with youth, not loving young people, but loving the whole idea of staying young and staying immature." You see, cultures, by their very definition, are to pass on the best of what's been learned so that the best of that culture can be maintained. In other words, one of the prime functions of a culture is to perpetuate itself and its values. In the same way, the development of a separate youth culture has functioned to perpetuate adolescence. The very existence of a youth culture places teenagers at cross purposes then with their own development. They need to leave the world of youth, but during their teenage years, they're indoctrinated into a culture that functions to maintain their immaturity. Let's think again about street gangs. Street gangs are the most maybe blatant picture of the dysfunctional power of a youth culture. In a gang, there's authority, strict rules, punishment, and a shared sense of values. But all these norms are determined by a group of young people not yet mature enough to make wise decisions consistently. The first and often the only solution to violence, almost exactly what you might have if you expected a preschool group to govern itself, the only solution for gangs is violence. If we can expect that any system, we can expect that any system run by children or teenagers is going to be dysfunctional. In our churches, if more than 10 people, 10 young people, are sitting together in worship, they tend to act at best like children, right? They snicker and rattle candy wrappers and often simply get up and leave the balcony, right? But if the same youth are sitting with their parents or divided among the total congregation, they almost without exception imitate the behavior of the adults they're around. We recently completed a 6-week confirmation class. It was recent when I wrote the book. It is now these young people are freshmen in college. We completed this confirmation class when they were in sixth grade. The boys in the class were so energetic that they became to be affectionately labeled the young Nazis. They would throw Barbie dolls and, there was always some sort of flame that seemed to erupt there in the class. And even with two pastors and three older high school kids in the group, the boys were successful in disrupting almost every week. But on the day that the members of the class were introduced to the session by their elder friend who sat next to them, we wondered if we had a different class altogether. The boys were quiet, attentive, respectful. Whose values did they imitate? Not each other's. They imitated the values of the adults that were there in the group. Stephen Glenn has estimated that by the time an average teenager is 16 years old, he is now as morally mature as a 1950s 12-year-old and 5 years behind European kids in abstract thinking. I agree with Glenn. I think we have placed our kids in a culture that slows them down developmentally. I hear a lot of people say, "Oh, kids today are so much more mature than we were when we were growing up." No, they're exposed to much more. We might say they're more sophisticated, but certainly they're not more mature. Youth culture, like most youth ministries, is essentially what I would call an orphaning structure. It does not carry its members through life. Rather, it orphans them at the time they're most in need of a stable culture. The isolation of teenagers from the world of adults has severely hindered the process that lead teenagers to mature adulthood. The structures that carry young people to adulthood must become the focus of youth ministry in the next generation. Let me go back and make one other sort of side comment, and I'm going to talk about implications of ministry, and then we'll move on to the next side of the tape. I said a few moments ago that we can expect that any system that is governed by teenagers or children will be dysfunctional. Again, that is somewhat controversial. There are those who say that young people need to be the ones to decide the agenda for youth ministry. And I have to tell you, that is not where I am. I think young people need to be deeply involved in the planning of youth ministry, but not by themselves. They need to be in partnership with adults. Often what happens, though, is the adults who could give clear direction and support and accountability to the young people, they fold up their hands and they say, "We just want to, whatever you kids want to do, you all know what is best." And I think that is a neglecting of our responsibility as adults. Our role is to pass on and to be the adults there and to be in significant dialogue, which often means disagreement with where the young people are. I often hear leaders making promises to kids that they just can't keep. In other words, they say, "You can do whatever you want. You can wear whatever you want to worship." Well, you know, if a girl comes in a halter top and cut off blue jeans and no shoes, at least in my church to worship, there's going to be some significant negative feedback. And one of the roles of an adult who is close to young people in the church is to help them have realistic boundaries and expectations of how they interact with the whole community of faith, so that they don't step into things that create difficulty or conflict for them in unhealthy sorts of ways. Okay, just a little free reflection there about that. Some implications of ministry. I got three of them and then a wild hair. One, the most important priority a church can have in its work with teenagers is providing them with opportunities for significant dialogue and relationships with mature adults. The priority does not require a massive budget or an extensive program. It does require a group of adult leaders in the church who make the creation of relationships between adults and teenagers a central priority of the youth ministry. Number two, churches must not depend on the communication vehicles of youth culture. Television with its frantic change of scenery for the chronically bored, or contemporary music with its make-me-feel-good priority, or successful athletes with their stories of freedom from failure. We can't count on those vehicles to carry the demanding claims of the gospel. All of these means may be helpful as thresholds to the Christian life, but they are not sufficient to carry the responsibility for developing spiritual maturity. That happens in significant dialogue, in discipling relationships, in spiritual direction kind of relationships. Number three, we must not be afraid to instill the value of participating in weekly corporate worship with the entire church family as a central priority for the youth ministry. I know that's hard. Many young people and many parents choose not to participate in worship because they say they don't get anything out of it. But I have to confess, I think there's something that happens in worship, boring though some worship styles may be, that simply does not happen anywhere else. The exclusive God focus of worship, the exclusive focus of we have gathered to give honor to God, is something that doesn't happen anywhere else on an exclusive basis. In other words, you can worship in a Sunday school class, but you've gathered there to learn something and to get something. Worship is different, and it's a place where kids learn that their essential identity are those who give glory to God rather than receive messages or comfort or something else from God. Here's the wild hair. Challenge the youth and the leaders in the church to fast from the cultural vehicles of value transmission, television, recorded music, and movies for 1 month, and share their experiences at the end of that month. Should be interesting. All right, let me ask you now to turn the tape over. You'll fast forward to the end of the tape and turn it over, and we will begin talking about the vision of family-based youth ministry.
Cash and I'll be in the next second. Our old fierce beast, no festival. Snaya boost, but, and I deal with all cam now. There's an I deal with all cam now. With only drops, all that learns and ask your assistant if you catch that. Make what? Make it, I've got money to find that catch net. No pop. Here's the snow patch. You'll be nervous. I don't know what that says. This plan to show some dab. Let's see the show. Meyer Gabbins, the owner of the jury, that's my no pop, Ruffy. He murdered with Cash Nickat City, but so fierce through snow, world fierce through snow. Cash Nickat, so fierce through snow, Cash Nickat, Cash North for Common Nickat. This is it. There's no cash, jump, surf, nice, none of us, get south, throw fierce through snow, cash, jump.